In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and exalted, seated on a throne, and the train of his robe filled the temple. And above him were seraphim, each with six wings, and with two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." And at the sound of their voices, the doorposts and the thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. "Woe to me," I cried. "I'm ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." And then one of the seraphim flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with tongs from the altar, and with it he touched my mouth, and he said, "See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away, your sin atoned for." And then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? Who will go for us?" I said, "Here am I. Send me." He said, "Go." It is in the year that King Uzziah died that Isaiah sees the king. Uzziah had been on the throne for 52 years. That would be a long reign in today's world. Back then, it was almost without precedent. He had been king since he was 16 years old. Uzziah's reign had been mixed but overall successful. The nation had become prosperous. It had become a time of great innovation. We know that from archaeological finds. And then he dies. It is the end of an era. It is a time of change and massive transition. It is a moment of national insecurity. These are the moments at which God speaks. If you find yourself at a time of great shaking and change, do not seek to ride out the storm. Press into the storm and find the eye. Because it is in those moments of shaking that God is most likely to speak, in the liminal moments that he reveals his presence. Uzziah's name meant "The Lord is my strength." That's just the literal meaning of Uzziah. The Lord is my strength. Sometimes the strength of the Lord upon which we have relied dies, and the healing does not happen, or the money runs out, or the vision does not seem to be working. These are the times of fresh commission. When we lose the people in whom we found our security, these are the times when we find our security in God. When we lose our human kings, we find the heavenly king. When we lose our earthly mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, we find heavenly family. When people we love die, when projects we love fail, when money is low, when the vision is Jesus, but Easter Sunday is taking a long time coming, God speaks. When nations shake, that's what Drew said. Syria, 120,000 people they estimate have died so far in the civil war in Syria. A few weeks ago, Israel was firing trial missiles. America was stationing warships in the Mediterranean. President Obama was requesting permission to engage militarily in Syria, as was David Cameron, as was the French president. And then the Pope said, hey, let's pray. 1st September, 7 days later, 70,000 people in St. Peter's Square, Rome, 2 million around the world praying and fasting for peace. My dear friends who follow me on Twitter who don't believe in the existence of God said, why don't people stop wasting their time praying and fasting and do something useful instead, as if we are not the people who are spending ourselves. If you give up food, if you pray, you give money, you engage politically, you go and move to another land to serve the poor, you immerse yourself in the refugee crisis. Religious people are not other. We're at the very heart of civilization. Always have been, always will be. What came of the prayer and fasting? Well, within 3 days, out of nowhere, Russia. President Putin came and brokered peace, and President Obama, with his tail between his legs, said, okay, we won't bomb. And then a few days ago, the process of removing chemical weapons from Syria began. Are we there yet? No. Is it a good start? Yeah. If we think that it's purely our prayers that did it, we are deluded. If we think our prayers have nothing to do with it, we are deluded. And so nations shake and we start to see movements of the spirit amongst the refugees. 1906, Azusa Street, the beginning of the Pentecostal charismatic movement, outpouring the Spirit on a 24/7 prayer room, Los Angeles, praying night and day, black and white, male and female together. They just had a massive earthquake shake Los Angeles. There's always shaking behind outpouring. The Hebridean awakening, the last great awakening to shake the British Isles. 1949 to 1953, they lost a disproportionate number of their young people in the war. They'd attended one too many funerals, and their thoughts, therefore, were upon heaven. Behind every outpouring, there is a shaking. Are you being shaken? Do not ride out the storm. Press in and seek the Lord, because it is when the King dies that you see the King. You know, no one's got a problem with prayer. People say to me, I just find prayer difficult. Or I have a prayer problem. But no one, it's a lie. No one has a prayer problem. I can prove it to you. If you go to the doctor one day and the doctor says you've got 3 weeks to live, you do not come away from that appointment and say, I'd really love to pray about this. But, you know, I find prayer very difficult. You just say, oh, God, help. We do not have a prayer problem. We have a comfort problem. And it's when the things in which we find comfort get shaken that we see and seek the Lord. And so Isaiah's mission begins with this extraordinary encounter with God. And your destiny will be unlocked when you encounter God. We've heard that again and again through these days. It may be dramatic as it was for Isaiah. It may be the Damascus Road, or it may be the Emmaus Road, far gentler, but you must encounter God. I heard about someone who went on an intensive Christian leadership training recruitment program. A whole bunch of people that wanted positions of leadership in a particular denomination. They went through psychometric testing. They were interviewed about their theology. They were asked to facilitate group discussions. And at no point in the entire 3-day process did anyone sit down and look any one of them in the eye and say, have you met him? Did he send you here? Have you met Jesus? And you say to me, that all sounds a little ethereal. No, it's not. Because I tell you why. The Apostle Peter would have failed the psychometric test. And he'd have been terrible at the group facilitation exercise. And I'm really not sure about Thomas's theology. But they got picked. They met Jesus, and the whole world shook, and it hasn't stopped shaking ever since. When you meet Jesus, you discover your destiny. That is why we cannot allow them to patronize prayer as if it's just some Earl Grey exercise for people who want to talk to squirrels. Prayer is the essence of humanity. We were created to walk and talk with God. And long before there was any sin or sickness or suffering in the world, we walked and talked with God. And one day there will be no more sin or sickness or suffering in the world, but we will walk and talk with God. And on that day, the evangelists won't know who to talk to because they're more used to talking to non-Christians than they are to God. And the justice activists won't know how to be happy because they're only happy when they're caring for broken people. And there won't be any more broken people around. You were not created to be a cog in God's machine for forwarding a religious brand or fighting injustice. These things are essentially important, but you were created to walk and talk with God as His children, in His home, as His friends. So prayer is where it begins, prayer is where it ends, and in the middle, we've got a little work to do, and all the time we do it, we miss Jesus. You are made for God, and your heart will not be at home until you rest with Him. Encounter God. So some of us flew thousands of miles to be reminded that we like Jesus. We like hanging out with Him. It's not a new story. St. Kieran, 546 AD, just up the road. You think we've got bad facial hair? He must have had terrible facial hair. He gathered seven friends and said, "Let's start praying." They built a wooden prayer room. You know, sometimes mobilizing prayer is pretty practical and you get splinters in your hands. And they built this wooden prayer room. They started praying. And that was the beginning of Clonmacnoise, where some of us are going on pilgrimage this afternoon. He only lasted a year. St. Kieran died after a year. Some of you go, "You know what? I don't have a very big team." He had seven people. He was 29 years old. Some of you say, "You know what? We've taken some blows." Well, when your founding leader dies after a year, that's a hell of a blow. But they kept going. They did not back off. And that prayer house became the Clonmacnoise Abbey. That continued until the year 1552. By my reckoning, that is more than 1,000 years of prayer at the heart of this island. And it became one of the preeminent centers of education, of hospitality, of spirituality, of pilgrimage, and of mission. And it was one of the centers of light in the dark ages that kept the good news of a civil society alive. Prayer changing and shaping and sculpting the culture. That's what I heard Esther Priscilla talk about. I got six friends together. Was it six, Esther? Six? It was six. Six people. Six people. And now 20,000 people encountering God in prayer. God is calling us back to seek His presence and sending us home with fresh hunger. The way you're going to keep the encounter alive is to go home not filled but hungry. I hope we have massively messed you up. I hope you go home dissatisfied, longing, frustrated, envious. I want what they've got. I want to hear You more, Lord. I want to see You more. Why is my spiritual experience so shallow? That's what I call a miracle. Thou hast put salt on our lips that we might thirst for Thee, said St. Augustine. So I've been kind of embarrassed how much people have talked about Red Moon Rising. I wrote it with Dave Roberts. Where's Dave? Dave's doing a house of prayer in France. You should go and check it out. And I'm embarrassed because really we ought to write another one some stage, because the stories that have happened since are much cooler and more exciting. Oh, and by the way, just before I get into that, we need a filmmaker, and we haven't got any money to pay you. We need somebody, because one of the things that strikes me is the stories I've heard over these few days are phenomenal. And I want us to release somebody who will travel the world capturing the stories in a way that does them justice on short films. And I reckon it sounds like about the coolest job you could possibly have. So basically, if you can raise your own support and trust God, we'll hook you up with. And as long as you're not like a Satanist or anything, we'll hook you up. You know, require first class travel or something like that. We'll hook you up with the people and the places, and maybe Red Moon Rising looks like a movie next rather than just a book. But we got to keep telling the stories, because when you're a movement, you move, and God's always doing a new thing, and you got to keep telling the stories, right? And so I don't know if that's someone here, but if it's you, my little Tarantino friend, I would like to meet you. So I mean, you probably need to be based at one of the sort of resource boiler rooms, and then we'll work it all out from there. You might need to move, I don't know. So, but here's the deal: when I finished writing Red Moon Rising, I was exhausted because I can only type with two fingers, and I'd been staring at a screen so long that my eyes were very dry and square, and my children were like orphans, and my wife was like a widow. And I'd been told that no one really reads Christian books, especially ones about prayer. So everyone was saying I was wasting my time. And then I called Sammy and the kids into the study, and I said, "Okay, I've finished, and it's time to press send." And the kids sat on my lap, and we said a little prayer and committed the manuscript to Jesus, and then they pressed send, and it went off. And then I'd been fantasizing about that moment for a long time. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. We were going to go to a, in the American version, it says a restaurant, but I'll be honest, it was a pub. If that shakes anyone's universe, I'm so sorry. And there's a really nice pub near us, and I knew it was the place to go because it had two vital ingredients. It had a playground for the children, slides and swings, and it had deep leather sofas, and I was bone tired. And we drove down there, and I collapsed into these leather seats, and I said to the children, "Go forth and play in the name of Jesus, the whole, verily, the swings and indeed the slides, the provision of the Lord." And one of the children, we got two boys, one of the children just went screaming out, "Yeah, slide, swings," he's off. The other one went towards the door and he stopped. And he turned right back and he looked at me. And he looked at the swings and he looked at me. And he walked very slowly back towards me and he climbed into my lap and he said this. He said, "Daddy, I've missed you." And he wouldn't leave. He just stayed in my lap. And I cannot tell you how much that ministered to my tired father's heart. Would he have been less my son had he gone and played on the swings? No. Did I love him more than the other one out there playing? No. But did it bless me unnecessarily? Yes. In prayer and worship, we have the opportunity to minister to the heart of the Father with unnecessary love. He doesn't make many demands of us. I don't know if you noticed that. But we have the opportunity to choose him instead of the television, to choose him instead of all kinds of other things, and it blesses his heart. Carol Arnott says there must be time for God, just to love him and have him love us. No other agendas, no list of prayer requests. These may come later, but we need to put loving him first, because only as we are filled with his love do we have love to give away. I've noticed we always want God to speak to us in specifics. We want the what, the when, the where, but generally he refuses to micromanage our lives. And instead of giving us the what, the where, and the when, he gives us the who, the why, and the how. So we go to God and we say, where should I go? And what should I do? And when should I do it? And he says, oh, I love you. Let's hang out. Doesn't it drive you crazy? What good is that? It's every good in the world, because from an encounter comes the commission. Do you know that you are the prayer room? Here's our theology. The prayer room is not the prayer room. The prayer room is just like a little catalyst. It's a little picture of something. Your heart and our communities are the actual 24/7 prayer room, hosting the presence of God night and day. So my question for you this, as you prepare to go home, is what laments and hallelujahs are written on the walls of your heart? What music is emanating through the prayer room of your soul? Where is God in your subconscious, your reflex reactions? Is he your first thought at night and when you wake in the morning? What dark corners are there still within each one of us? Because I noticed that Isaiah sees God and he says, oh, I'm a man of unclean lips and I live amongst a people of unclean lips and I've seen God. And so we come into the presence of God and we become aware of our shame and our inadequacy. And we look at people doing amazing things and we compare ourselves unfavorably. And he comes and he burns our lips and says, is that good enough for you? Have my blood, have my vital organs. You live, I die, go. I have made you clean. And the privilege of interviewing Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, just asking him some questions with some others. It was last year. And here was my question for him. I said, Archbishop, how have you kept the fire in your belly all these years? Still fighting injustice. Still, you know, championing reconciliation. And he said this to me instantly. He said, oh, that is because when I was trained as a priest, I did so in a monastery, in a place of prayer. And I learned that prayer is the context for everything else. It is prayer and prayer alone that has kept the fire burning in my soul all these years. Bono once said to Tutu, do you find time for prayer with all this stuff you're doing? And he said, if I didn't find time for prayer, I wouldn't be doing all the other stuff. And so my question for us as a movement, my provocation before we feel too good about ourselves is this. Where are the monastic communities today in which tomorrow's Nobel Peace Prize winners, political leaders, entrepreneurs, and great creative artists, where are the communities in which they are being nurtured in the presence of God, the way that Clonmacnoise and all those ancient monasteries nurtured civilization back then? Because we could do that. I'm not talking about just a nice little twist on church getting a few people saved. I'm talking about a whole old paradigm in which there is such a sense of the presence of God that there is innovation and grace and relationship and release and encouragement in such a way that we change the world together. You know, there's a guy called Alastair MacIntyre. He's a really well-respected Scottish philosopher. And he wrote a book called After Virtue. And he was particularly thinking about the sort of moral crisis that we're in globally right now. And he draws some comparisons with the moral crisis at the fall of the Roman Empire and the Dark Ages. He says this. A crucial turning point in that earlier history, so that was, you know, the fall of the Roman Empire, occurred when men and women of goodwill turned aside from the task of shoring up the Roman Imperium and ceased to identify the continuation of civility and moral community with the maintenance of that imperium. Okay, so they realized we can't expect government and the prevailing culture to generate and protect morality. So what they did instead is they set themselves to achieve, often not recognizing fully what they were doing, the construction of new forms of community within which the moral life could be sustained so that both morality and civility might survive the coming ages of barbarism and darkness. We, he says, have reached that turning point. What matters at this stage is the construction of local forms of community within which civility and the intellectual and moral life can be sustained through the new dark ages which are already upon us. And if the tradition of the virtues was able to survive the horrors of the last dark ages, we are not entirely without grounds for hope. This time, however, the barbarians are not waiting beyond the frontiers. They have already been governing us for quite some time. And it is our lack of consciousness of this that constitutes part of our predicament. We are, he says, waiting not for a Godot, but for another, doubtless very different, St. Benedict. We're looking for Benedicts. We're looking for St. Francis's. We're looking for St. Kieran's, for St. Patrick's. That's why I love to see the videos from the Manor House community in Switzerland, from the Boiler Room in Kansas City. You know, a girl came in having just got pregnant out of wedlock, thinking that Christians will reject her now. And instead, Wendy and the crew instinctively gathered around her, embraced her, and said, "That is the most wonderful news. A new life has begun. Grace, not law." That's why I love what Grand Rapids are doing with their whole vision for education. That's why I love the stories of Ibiza rescuing people night after night. That's why I love the radical hospitality in the Stanford Boiler Room. That's why I love what's going on in Schüttke, creating education for some of the poorest children in that massive Romani community. That's why I love the stories from HTB and the prayer room there, where we had over 1,000 people at midnight New Year's Eve turn up to pray, and lines going all the way down the street round the corner towards Harrods. And we had to turn people away from a prayer meeting in central London. We must encounter God, but out of our encounter with God, we also encounter one another. We build family. I think, are sent home to renew our commitment to love those who aren't like ourselves. And we've been stretched with that over these few days. I'm trying to learn more and more, when I find people who are different from me, not to ask what's wrong with them, but what's right with them. What can I learn from them? Where is Jesus in them? Where can I bless them? By the way, if some of you are feeling stirred about this whole thing of boiler rooms and new monastic communities, centers of prayer that are making a measurable difference amongst the poor and the lost, I had a very successful person contact me recently. He said, "I'm working with government in Belize, and we've got a center, a big building complex. We've got educational programs we're running, but we want to turn the center into a new monastery. Have you got a team that would like to come and set something up that will have inroads into government, inroads into education, could make a difference in the land, but we've realized that there needs to be a monastic community at the heart of it?" This isn't rhetoric, guys. This is an actual opportunity. And so if you're thinking, "Wow, I fancy taking on a nation," then you might. I'm not promising you. I'm not just going to hire any old person for something like that, but come and talk. We encounter one another. And then finally, we encounter the world out of our encounter with God. So Isaiah sees God, but God isn't staring in the mirror. God is seeing us. God is seeing the pain of the world. He's seeing the need. And I heard that from Jesse Joe, who said, "You know, I got saved and I found myself caught up in a community of love and worship. And then I suddenly started to think of the girls around the corner who are selling themselves, even as we worship." And so out of being called into the love of God and encounter with God, we are sent out to encounter the pain of the world. I heard that from Alan Scott, saying, "You know, I only ever wanted to be a contemplative mystic and die at the age of 28. I spent all my time just praying in my bedroom. And then one day God said to me, 'You need to get out and find my heart. And he said, well, I already found your heart. I'm praying all the time in my bedroom. And God said, my heart is with the people. And Alan Scott said, I don't like people. Thank God he got out of his prayer room. Because now he's planted a church that's seen one in every 40 people in his community come to know him, and they're seeing miracles and salvation on a daily basis. You know what's happening in his church is every bit as significant as what's happening in Redding, California. And I love and honor what's happening in Redding, California. But please, let's not get caught up in the commercialism around pilgrimage sites, because God is doing something bigger than every personality, every product, every brand. And as we give ourselves to prayer, as we encounter God, we will find that, you know what, it was never the special person or the special place. It was the presence of the Lord Jesus in willing servants. You just can't be a true prayer movement unless you're also a mission movement. The deeper we journey into God's heart, the deeper we are propelled into the things that are on his heart. You cannot separate passion for Jesus from compassion for his world. And so Adam reminded us how God's love completes us. And then Aaron White reminded us of how God's love compels us outwards. That is what motivates Drew to be doing what he is doing in the Syrian refugee camps in Libya. That's what's motivating Emily to go and reopen the work in Boys Town, Reynosa. That's what's motivating the guys in Asia. Wasn't that a cool story about the guy walking through Tibet and he had the word of knowledge, the pain in his shoulder? Wasn't that a good story? And he goes up to this guy and says, I've had a word for you. Have you got a problem with your shoulder? And the guy looks at him and goes, no, because last time you came to our village 2 years ago, you came and said the same thing to me. You've obviously forgotten. And I did have a pain in my shoulder. You prayed for me. I was completely healed. You disappeared. And I've been meditating at the temple about Jesus Christ ever since. And I'm rather glad God sent you back to tell me the next chapter. God's love compels us outwards. Let me finish with one story. 2 years ago, one of the great heroes of the faith died. His name, of course, it was David Wilkerson. And you may know the story, but on February the 9th, 1958, God spoke to him as a pastor and said to him, would you stop watching television and start praying every evening? So he switched off his TV and began to pray every night. And after 2 weeks of praying every night, he began to read one night Life magazine. And as he read the story of 7 gang members who were on trial for killing a 15-year-old polio victim, he just began to weep. The things on the heart of God began to break his heart. And God spoke to him and said, go and help those boys. These were not worthy, needy people. These were boys on trial for killing a polio victim. Did you know that God cares as much about those doing the trafficking as the trafficked people? God cares for the abuser as well as the abused. Till we resolve that in our heart, then we aren't truly championing justice. We will perpetrate injustice in our very pursuit of justice. If God's cross is not big enough for the vilest of sinners, there is no hope for you and me. And so he goes to New York City and he finds these 7 gang members and he encounters Nicky Cruz, the leader of the Mau Maus. And Nicky Cruz threatens to kill him, as you know. And he comes out with that immortal line. He says, you could cut me to 1,000 pieces and every piece would cry out, God loves you. And Nicky Cruz gives his life to the Lord. And the cross and the switchblade, the book he wrote about it, has sold 50 million copies and is often seen as one of the reasons that the charismatic renewal spread into the Catholic Church. And we saw some of the fruits of that yesterday. And there's a teen challenge that David Wilkerson founded, has now 1,000 centers in 82 countries, treating 24,000 young people a day to get free from addictions. All because one rural pastor responded to God's call to switch off his television and begin to pray. Do you understand that in encounter with God, we catch the things on God's heart and are sent out to make a difference in the world? 13 years ago, having with Sammy just planted our second church as part of Revelation down the south coast, God called me to pray. And it was the thing I was worst at. And out of that, I've stepped into the wildest ride and met all of you lot and heard the most incredible stories and been left continually shaking my head in amazement at the things that God does when we simply prioritize his presence. 11 years ago, Andy Freeman started the first boiler room because, having been trying to do youth work for ages, he found that by calling young people to pray, they got discipled. And then the first boiler room started, and now there's boiler rooms all over the world. 8 years ago, Brian and Tracy responded to that call to go to Ibiza. And look what's happening now. 7 years ago, Adam Cox and David and Molly Blackwell and others started this little community in Kansas City because they said, we can't just keep doing all the God stuff without actually reaching out. And as they began to reach out, the Kansas City Boiler Room was founded. 2 years ago, John Peterson received a clear call from God in prayer to engage with the land in which he was born, Japan. And now the work is growing there. Out of prayer and encounter with God, everything else flows. The simple secret to unlocking your destiny is prayer. So I just wonder whether God is waiting to give you your go help those boys moment for which you were born. Carl Wills spoke to us about this being a moment of fresh commissioning. Now is the time, he said. We are at the moment as a movement crossing new frontiers into the Roman Catholic world, into Asia, into the Muslim world. And I wonder what this means then for you to take the encounter home. Maybe it's just to get your church praying, to do the new prayer course that we've just released, to get a prayer space going in a school, to root yourself in with a boiler room community, to maybe do the vision course, come and make movies for us. Maybe it's to move somewhere missionally. Pick your continent, Africa. Why don't you go and help Pete Portal and the guys in Manningburg? Asia, why don't you go and help Wendy and the guys in Hong Kong? Europe, why don't you go and help the guys in Ibiza? America, why don't you go and join Emily in Mexico? Maybe it's simply a call to seek God afresh. Has God lit a fresh passion in your heart in these days? Then I'll finish with the words that St. Ignatius used to use to send missionaries out, like Francis Xavier, who went, of course, to China. He would gather all these gnarly old Ignatian monks, and he said to them, go forth and set the world on fire. Let it be said.